Well, thank you very much, and what a kind and generous introduction. I'm going to stand because I'm incredibly jet-lagged, and if I don't, I'll just doze off while I'm talking, and that would be very unfortunate. I am extremely pleased to be here, and I am delighted to see you here. I thought, frankly, there might just be three of us sitting around the table here talking, so you've already dramatically exceeded my expectations. And actually, there are a number of us, sort of the audience is packed with friends of mine, but in particular, I want to introduce Chris Kuhner. Chris is a partner in Hunton & Williams and a great scholar of data protection law and has probably forgotten more than I will ever know, so I'm daunted. If I don't do well, I'll just sit down and let him give the talk instead. So what I would like to talk about is this sort of intersection between data protection law and the growth of digital data in the world around us. And my thesis is a very simple one, which is that we live in a world of really what I think we could accurately describe as ubiquitous data collection and use. And in the face of such digital data proliferation, our current approaches to data protection law on both sides of the Atlantic are frankly failing. And therefore, when we deal with issues such as those that Chris specializes in about how do we harmonize data protection law, right now we would be harmonizing among alternatives that aren't working. So in fact, I come back to first principles and say, how do we make data protection first viable in the face of this rich and at times threatening digital environment, and at the same time protect fundamental privacy rights, which right now are going unprotected because of the failure of these approaches. So let me say, over the past, two decades, we've seen 60-odd countries adopt data protection laws, largely in response to the European Union's Data Protection Directive, which created the standard that other nations had to meet, or else they ran the risk of facing burdens or actual prohibitions on the export of data from the European Union to other countries. So these data protection laws come in all different forms and varieties. We've seen them enacted pretty much on every continent. But almost always scholars talk about these as being a spectrum of data protection laws with Europe at one side and the United States at the other side. And maybe this is just because most of the scholars live in Europe or the United States and they like to talk about something they know about, but I'm going to fall into that same trap as well. I'm going to talk just a moment about these two ends of the spectrum before talking about the challenges posed by digital data. So Europe, as you know, was the site of the first national data protection law, as well as the first provincial data protection law. But it really was the directive adopted in 1995, which caused all of the now 27 member states of Europe to have to enact national data protection laws, which they all have done so. And these data protection laws are characterized by a number of common elements. The first is a presumption that you cannot process data. You cannot use, collect, store, destroy, share, anything with data without meeting the requirements of national law. There's a presumption against the flow of data unless you meet these requirements. And these requirements generally require government authorization and or individual authorization. But at a minimum, government authorization, you have to notify a data protection authority within each country, and in some cases you have to have explicit permission, in some cases you have to have implied permission before you can go ahead and process data. And data processing, the terms all apply very broadly, and in fact apply to almost anything you would do with data about a natural person, with the exception of activities which are outside of the scope of community law and therefore may be excluded from the directive even though they may be subject to national laws. And fundamentally, we're talking about national security or in some cases criminal law, which are outside of the scope of community law. Otherwise, the directive applies. In certain cases, for example, the processing of special categories of data, that's a term used in the directive, data, racial or ethnic origin, political opinions, religious beliefs, philosophical or ethical persuasion, or concerning health or sexual life, the directive imposes even greater restrictions and generally forbids the processing of data without the written permission of the individual. So consent alone is not sufficient. You have to have written consent, written opt-in, affirmative consent. And then, of course, Articles 25 and 26 of the directive create this, what we call the adequacy standard, which says you cannot export data outside of the European Union unless it fits within a number of exceptions, one of which is consent, to countries lacking adequate data protection. And under the directive, that cannot be a European Union member. So the directive can't be used as a block reason for blocking the flow of data within the European Union, but it must be used to block data flowing outside of the European Union unless adequacy is found or one of the other exceptions apply. So the United States, by contrast, has a very different data protection system. It's highly contextual. It is based only in part on affirmative law or public law. Largely, it's based on private law or private agreements, self-regulation, in some cases, even implied agreements, which are then enforced by federal or state law. We have incredibly sectoral laws. And let me just give you a very practical example of this. For example, we have three entirely different federal laws to regulate name and address information resulting from subscription to cable television, obtaining telephone service, or renting DVDs. So three activities, frankly, all of which are fairly innocuous. We have completely separate laws, even though they might all involve the transmission of video programming. So these are technology-specific, very complicated and complex situation. Of course, we have 51 state privacy laws. On top of this, we count the District of Columbia as a state for this purpose, just in case you think, I don't know how many states the United States has, which is possible. I might be wrong. And in addition, as I mentioned, then we have all of these private ordering agreements. So let me just briefly comment on four characteristics a lot of U.S. law, though, has in common, despite its great complexity. One is, generally, most uses are permitted under these laws. So, for example, our financial privacy law, the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Financial Services Modernization Act, Title V of which regulates privacy, has lots and lots of text, but it actually permits all uses of data with one exception only, and that is the sharing of data with an unrelated third party for marketing a non-financial product or service. So if you actually read all of the Act and all of the notice requirements and all of the other requirements in the law, everything's permitted. The law's exceptionally permissive. Second, in almost all cases, we require notice even where there's no possibility of consent or withholding consent. So for example, under the, again, financial services privacy laws, we require that we not only provide the notice initially, you have to send it every single year, even though the notice is not telling the consumer anything that the consumer can actually act on, right? They have no legal rights, but you must provide notice telling them about the rights they don't have. Heavy reliance, the third point, on private ordering arrangements, even to the point of privacy notices on websites, which our Federal Trade Commission, our primary federal privacy regulator, treats as creating enforceable obligations. This is a tremendous challenge for lawyers because almost nobody reads privacy notices. In fact, nobody reads privacy notices as a statistical matter. Nevertheless, the state attorneys general and the Federal Trade Commission treat these as creating enforceable contracts. It's a great challenge to contract law because it's very hard to have a contract where neither side knows what it's promised or what it's agreed to. Nevertheless, under our Federal Trade Commission Act, Section 5 of which prohibits unfair and deceptive trade practices, the commission has successfully argued in more than 100 cases, all of which settled, none of which have gone to judgment, that not acting consistently with your privacy policy is a deceptive or an unfair trade practice. So therefore, you can be obligated to live up to standards, even though nobody knows what those standards are, and therefore most privacy regulation, as a practical matter, occurs through private ordering, not through public law. And finally, all of our laws, all of our data protection laws in the United States present access, permit access by the federal government. Sometimes actually under lower standards, it's an odd thing. For example, our federal health privacy rules, which deal with health information, actually lower the pre-existing standard for government to get access to data. So although this occurs in a very different way than in Europe it's largely because the Data Protection Directive comes out of a process that lacks competence over many government activities. In the United States, the net effect is that the government gets access to almost anything it wishes. Now, these laws, as you might expect, not just the United States and Europe, but other countries involved as well, intrinsically lead to international conflicts over transfers of data. Sometimes quite explicitly, as with Article 25 and 26 of the directive. There are other examples not involving Europe. For example, the three Canadian provinces, led first by British Columbia, adopted explicit restraints on the flow of data to countries that did not provide the sort of protection that would be required under Canadian law. These were somewhat politically motivated, maybe even as part of labor disputes in the British Columbia situation. But nevertheless, the laws remain on the books and are specifically dealing with the situation of the U.S. Allowing government access to records, which might be prohibited, for example, under Canadian law or under Canadian provincial law. Now, despite these international conflicts, international trade has not come to a standstill. We're not seeing the absolute blockage of data. And there are a number of tools that have made this possible. Between the United States and Europe, there's been this long negotiated safe harbor agreement, which I'm not going to talk about, for which you should be grateful. But under that agreement, generally speaking, U.S. businesses voluntarily agree to be subject to European-like privacy principles. And because of that voluntary agreement, which are then enforced under U.S. law by the U.S. Federal Trade Commission, or in some cases, the Department of Transportation, European data protection commissioners have allowed this flow of data to continue. But again, this is limited in certain contexts. For example, it doesn't apply in the financial services sector at all. And there are other limits that apply, for example, when dealing with employment-related data. There are other tools as well, binding corporate rules being one of the most commonly used now, in which, again, companies engage in a process with European Union data protection officials or national European data protection officials in order to get their corporate policies acknowledged as meeting the requirements of European law. And then under those corporate policies, data can flow. Now, against this fairly regulatory, or what the Israeli Data Protection Commissioner Yoram HaCohen has called the bureaucracy of privacy protection. Against this, we have to look at the reality of data flows today. So think for a moment about the explosion in digital data and in the demand for digital data by governments and private sectors alike. Business Week wrote not long ago, with the rise of new networks, we are channeling the details of our lives into vast databases. Every credit card purchase, every cell phone call, every click on the computer mouse feeds these digital treasure troves. Those with the tools and skills to make sense of them can begin to decipher our movements, our desires, our diseases, our shopping habits, and even predict our behavior. Close quote. So we're talking here not only about transactional data, but also about a vast amount of new data being collected by ever-expanding sensor networks. So these networks, for example, can include everything from the video cameras that populate the streets of London and most other cities, but also sensor networks, for example, the computers embedded in our cars. The average new car today has 12 separate computers, each of which collect data about our driving habits, our driving location, and so forth. And those data can then be either accessed remotely in the case of OnStar and systems like that, or can be accessed by physical contact with the vehicle. For example, you take your vehicle to be worked on by a mechanic. But think of also just the volumes that we are talking about here. So for example, more than 60 billion debit and credit card transactions every year. 294 billion emails a day that we generate, most of which are junk. 6.1 trillion text messages. Voicemail, voice over IP conversations, all of these, of course, are digital. Think about the more than 5 billion mobile phones worth worldwide, every one of which records location as well as other data. For example, most of them have video phones or video cameras in them. Or the Wi-Fi networks, which we populate through our devices or our iPass or FastPass or EasyPass or even US passports today, which come with a RFID chip embedded in them. Contactless payment systems. I was in a store this morning and saw a sign that said, "We accept contactless payment system for charges under £10. That limit, of course, isn't going to last for long. Contactless payment systems are certainly where we're headed. the iTunes Music Store has downloaded 15 billion songs in the past year and 14 billion applications from the iTunes App Store. Every one of those transactions, of course, involves collecting personal data, both about the user, the password information, and so forth, but also about the device, where they're going, the number of times they're used, when they're used, where they're used, and so forth. What we're doing in our office, in public, at home, in buildings with video and audio surveillance, key card systems, security systems, keystroke monitoring, stored email and voicemail at the office. I mentioned the cameras in London. It's very hard keeping up with the data on the cameras in London, but the last published statistics by British officials were 2006, that the traffic surveillance in cameras in London collected 8 terabytes of data every day. That's a lot of data. I could draw out the zeros if you wish, but just take my word, it's a lot of data. All of the things we look for and are interested in and search for, think about internet search terms, for example. As of a year ago, we were generating about 113 billion searches a month, every one of which is recorded and linked with information on the computer, if not the user. That number, by the way, over the past decade has doubled every 2 years, has doubled every year. So what's the number as of today? Who knows? Certainly more than 200 billion. Think about all of the information we post online, 5 billion photos posted onto Flickr, 2 billion videos watched on YouTube. Facebook alone has more than 700 million users. That's 10% of the world's population. And of course, all not only their data, but the usage of the data, who accesses it, who sees it, who shares it, and so forth, all of which is collected. Twitter handles 155 million tweets, something which should not be a word, every day. Okay. So think about this. The former dean of Stanford Law School, Professor Kathleen Sullivan, has written, "Our biographies are etched in the ones and zeros that we leave behind in these daily digital transactions. These zeros and ones describe us, they identify us, and increasingly they define us to others." Think of all of the people or institutions we deal with solely through exchange of data. We've never laid eyes on them. We have no other human contact. Mark Rotenberg, executive director of the Electronic Information Center, has put it a little more directly. We are recording our preferences, our hopes, our worries, and our fears. At the same time, remember, demand for personal data from businesses, from the government, from other organizations continues to escalate. Right. Following the terrorist attacks of 9/11, the London bombings, the Madrid bombings, and of course the other terrorist attacks we've seen over the past decade, the government has expanded on what was already an almost insatiable appetite for data in an effort to detect, to prevent, and to catch the perpetrators of terrorist and other criminal attacks. Of course, companies also want access to data, largely for marketing purposes, but also for fraud prevention, for various other purposes as well. And remember that the data we're talking about here are all digital data, right? You say, what does it matter that they're digital? Well, a number of things matter. First of all, it means we're capturing data to describe things that historically would never have resulted in data. Things we would have previously had a conversation about, there would have been no record whatsoever, today are going to be captured in emails. The fact they're digital means that they are going to be replicated. Think about an email, for example. I have a copy, my ISP has a copy, every switch along the way has a copy, your ISP has a copy, you have a copy, and then when you hit reply all instead of reply, everyone else in the entire universe is going to have a copy of this information. These data are easily shared, they're easily searched, they are easily made useful. So unlike having analog data, you know, notes on a note card, which were nearly impossible to use, these data are intrinsically valuable and useful. They are almost impossible to delete. Remember, data are not transmitted, they are copied. Think of a fax machine when you think about moving data. So no matter how hard you try to delete data, it is virtually impossible to do so, in part because we've built in so many systems to avoid us deleting things, letting us delete things we care about. Right? Undelete is a good example of that. Back, reverse, undo, the trash can on both Apple and Microsoft products. would be an example. But even when you think you've done everything you possibly can to delete data, I think you would find that it's almost impossible to do so. But most significant about almost all of these digital data examples I've talked about, they all result in data being held by somebody else. Right? You may take the photograph, but it's going to be held by Flickr. You may be listening to the music, but it's Apple who's going to record the information about what you're listening to and when. In every case, we're talking about data being collected and stored by third parties. Now, when we look at our current data protection regimes, whether in the US or Europe or any place in between, what we see is a system that largely, no matter which system we're talking about, is incapable of working in the face of this huge explosion, this proliferation of digital data. Richard Thomas, the former Information Commissioner of the United Kingdom, put it this way when he was commissioner. He said the approach of the directive, he was only talking about Europe here, but he could just as easily have been talking about the United States, is now outdated in terms of both technology and modern regulatory approaches. Technology has moved on massively in the last 20 years, yet it is a mainframe directive. So let me just quickly touch on four broad areas of criticism that would apply equally to the United States or to Europe or to any of the systems in between. One of them is, of course, the still significant reliance on notice and choice or notice and consent, whatever phrase you want to use. Really, ever since the beginning of the scholarly work on privacy, for example, the 1967 study, Privacy and Freedom by Alan Weston, we have tended to define privacy in regulatory terms as, and I'm quoting from Dr. Weston, the claim of individuals, groups, or institutions to determine for themselves when, how, and to what extent information about them is communicated to others. In other words, we've defined it in terms of control. If I have control over information, I have privacy. And all of our regulatory instruments tend to reflect this. If we start, for example, with the OECD guidelines on the protection of privacy and transborder flows of personal data, 1980, the basic principles which we almost all claim to reflect in our national laws, the first principle stated for data protection is that it is only lawful to collect data with the consent of the data subject or by other authority of law. In other words, if the law doesn't specifically authorize it, like, for example, looking at a passport to enter a country, then the only legitimate basis for data protection is with the consent of the data subject. The directive reflects a similar preoccupation with consent. And if you just search for the term consent in the data protection directive, you'll find it in article after article. Right, Article 7 of the directive provides seven conditions under which personal data may be processed. The first is the data subject has unambiguously given his consent. Article 8 restricts the processing of sensitive data except, and I quote, where the data subject has given his explicit consent. Article 26 identifies six exceptions to the provision prohibiting the export of personal data to non-European countries lacking adequate protection. The first is the, quote, the data subject has given his consent unambiguously to the proposed transfer. This, by the way, is true of all of the types of data protection standards we've seen, new codes, old codes, regional codes. The Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Forum has its own privacy framework, and again, adopted in 2004, it focuses very much on choice. Where appropriate, individuals should be provided with clear, prominent, easily understandable, accessible, and affordable mechanisms to exercise choice in relation to the collection, use, and disclosure of their personal information. That's its first principle. Increasingly, we've come to actually think of privacy as choice. If there's choice, there must be privacy. This is very much a US preoccupation. Right? So, for example, when the US Federal Trade Commission looked at fair information practices around the world, it identified five that it thought were critical when it reported to Congress in the mid-1990s. Of those, it highlighted two as most important, notice and choice. According to the commission, and I quote, the most fundamental principle is notice because without notice, a consumer cannot make an informed choice as to whether and to what extent to disclose personal information. And US statutes uniquely reflect this. Let me give you just one example here, again, from the privacy rule adopted under our Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act in 2001. This one rule, federal rule, includes three different choice requirements depending upon the use of the personal health information. it has a different name for each one. One it calls an acknowledgement, one an authorization, one an agreement, right? Nice legal terms. It's a wonderful area to practice law in because almost nobody understands it, but all require individual awareness and choice. The problem is, of course, choice is highly problematic. It has not worked well in practice, and it's certainly not going to work well in a world of extensive data collection. So, for example, let me just highlight quickly highlight some obstacles to this. One is that almost nobody is aware of data protection or reads the privacy notices when given the choice to. We have excellent data about this. I could bore you with statistics for the entire evening. Literally, we can count on our hands in this room the number of people who have read privacy policies from some of the world's most widely visited sites. So X-Site at Home, for example, a site no longer widely visited, had 60 million unique visitors, 200 of which visited its privacy policy, right? We're not talking a significant number. If you're not a statistician, don't worry. It's less than 1% in any setting that we're talking about. Moreover, remember that the preoccupation with choice effectively shifts the burden for protecting privacy from the user, from the processor, to the individual. Right, so the moment this legal fiction operates in which you say, well, I visited your website, I must have read your policy, therefore I've now consented, you've now shifted the burden. Previously, the processor might have had the obligation, under European law, would have had the obligation. But now in the United States, we would say now it's the individual who has the obligation. You've given consent, therefore whatever happens, tough luck. Third, remember, consent is not the same thing as privacy protection. So when you have a law focused on consent, and again, the US is the poster child for this, you are often completely missing privacy as a goal. You are instead focused only on consent. And then fourth, you might think about the fact that in many, many instances, we don't actually care about what the individual thinks. Right, so we might create an illusion of choice, but in reality, the individual has no choice. Whether that's an airline pilot who's screened for consumption of alcohol, where I don't think most of us would favor a large degree of choice about whether we allow pilots to do that, or whether that's when, for example, we enter the country and have to show a passport. Try to exercise your choice in Heathrow. It does nothing in most instances, but in the face of dramatic explosions in data, it's going to do even less. Right, one statistic which I carry around with me because I find so striking, researchers at Carnegie Mellon calculated that for US residents to read privacy policies associated with only the 50 most popular websites in the world would take collectively between 40 and 67 billion hours a year. At a national annual cost, depending upon what you think the minimum wage should be, of between $560 billion and $1.1 trillion US dollars. Now, if you want to talk about a tax on an economy, that would be a good example. Right? We should take $1 trillion out of the economy while we pay people to take time off from their lives or jobs or work or whatever they're doing to read privacy policies so that they can make informed choices. But of course, as data expands, it's going to be, as it already is, impossible to make meaningful choices. We're not going to know. You're not going to be aware. For example, there's a video camera there. There's another one there. Did we ask you each individually to record your choice? But heaven forbid, if you speak, you're going to be captured on camera. In fact, I'm confident we're in violation of the directive. Is that right? You see the problem. Think about just walking through a street corner. One of the things I've been in London for the weekend. It's been a lovely time to be in London, fabulous weather, Remembrance Weekend, a very good time to be there. But what I've been doing is photographing cameras on street corners. And it's wonderful. So what you do is you take a picture of a street corner and then you zoom in and you see how many cameras you can count. And if you can't count a dozen at least, you're just not trying. Right? So what does consent look like there? You know, what does choice look like? Right? But second problem, if the problem is too big for individuals to address, if it's too burdensome, if the data collection is too ubiquitous, what chance do data protection authorities have? Right? Against billions of transactions every day, we have in Europe 2,000, 3,000 data protection professionals. Right? What is the likelihood that this tiny, dedicated, well-meaning force for good is going to have any effect against 90 trillion emails a year. A third reason we might worry about choice and notice as the focus of our data protection systems, or as important to our data protection systems, is of course so many uses of data are outside of the choice regime. National security, immigration law, law enforcement, internal investigations, medical research, you can go on and on and on. So that at a certain point, you reach the point you say, these exceptions are largely making the rules meaningless. I can tell you all about choice, but you don't have any, so So you may feel good that you have an illusion of choice about one thing, but not the 15 others I can do with your data. A fourth issue, and the last one I want to touch on with regard to the data protection systems today, is that we do have this problem of inconsistency, even within harmonized regimes. This is certainly true in the United States, where we have sectoral laws, we have private ordering, we have state laws, we have local laws. Therefore, it's extremely complicated to ever know at any given moment in time, and it's utterly meaningless to the individual to know, as I browse the internet and go from a site on financial services to a site on healthcare to a site on something else, which legal structure applies as I move. But frankly, it's also been true in Europe and elsewhere, even in countries under the European Union Data Protection Directive, the purpose of which was to harmonize these laws so that data flows would not be impeded and privacy would be protected. Right? Despite being subject to a common directive, we see wide variance across the European Union, something widely talked about within Europe. This isn't just an American coming to cast stones. And the trajectory is not positive on either side of the Atlantic. In both Europe and the US, there are major developments. In Europe, of course, the directive is under review. We expect revisions to the directive out early next year in 2012. In the United States, we've had a multi-year process led by the Federal Trade Commission looking at privacy and data protection and how to address these in the context of, as the FTC puts it, an era of rapid change. But the early signs from Europe are not particularly comforting. Right? There are no signs that these tried and true approaches, even though they've been demonstrated not to work, will not continue to be used. And in the United States, we already know, because we have a draft report out from the Federal Trade Commission, that despite pages castigating, for example, the reliance on notice and consent, at the end of the day, notice and consent is still in the recommendations, right? Largely because they don't seem to be able to think of anything better. Europe is particularly a difficult situation right now because of an apparent conflict between Vice President Viviane Reding, who is dealing with human rights issues around data protection, and data protection commissioners who are dealing with a broader range of governance issues around data protection. But for example, she has repeatedly and publicly called for a right to be forgotten in data. Right? So the data would somehow have to expire, or you would be subject to audit to have dated digital data be deleted. Right? Think about that again in terms of that 1.1 trillion emails a year. Who's going to audit for that? And who's going to enforce that around the world, given that the email are going to be found around the world? There still remains a significant focus on government control, on consent, and the issue of national security and intelligence has not been dealt with effectively on either side of the Atlantic. It still largely operates as an exception to our data protection regime. So let me conclude by offering some recommendations. I actually ended up with 11 recommendations. I knew that was untenable, that would never be accepted, to have an odd number and more than 10 and so forth. So I randomly today on the train ride here cut out one so that there would only be 10 recommendations, even though I'm aware that having more than five is already on dangerous ground. So let me be fairly brief about these, not because I don't have a lot to say, I could go on indefinitely about these, but because you may have questions or rejoinders or feel like you deserve equal time. The first, I think, when thinking about data protection, particularly given the importance of data flows to our economy, to our livelihood, to our security, to research, to things we all care about, we should be mindful of the principle that we also use in healthcare, which is first, do no harm. Right? We should not rely on tools that are demonstrated not to work, but that also impose very high costs, simply because we don't know what else to do. It is important that we first, do no harm, that we make sure that we have in mind the broader issues of which data protection are only a part. A former UK Commissioner Thomas, who I mentioned earlier, said about the current situation, and I quote, "In the era of extraordinarily high volume data flows, the need for prior authorization or approval is an old-fashioned but also unrealistic regulatory tool." Right? It's time we abandon unrealistic tools because they neither serve the interests of the public, which are vital and need to be served, and at the same time they impose cost on all of us. Second, we need to focus more on objectives than means. Right? The goal should be a high standard of data protection. What does that mean? Well, then we would need to discuss it. In different cultures, we're going to have different sensitivities about data. But rather than focus so much on what data processors must do, we should focus on what they must achieve. A good example of this, and one that could bode well, although for the moment I don't think it does, is the growing discussion on both sides of the Atlantic about accountability. That rather than look at a lot of meticulous rules, we should say data stewards should be accountable for their use of data. If they use it in a way that causes harm or invades human dignity or otherwise imposes costs, they should be liable for those costs. And accountability would say, we don't really care how you accomplish that. The goal is that you accomplish it, and you'll be liable if you don't accomplish it. I don't think that is how accountability is going to move forward, because we all have trouble giving up our tried and true familiar regulatory tools. But focusing more on objectives than means might help us achieve better data protection at a much lower cost. Third, we need to be specific, or if not specific, at least clear about our lack of specificity as to what our objectives are. It's amazing how reluctant people in data protection on both sides of the Atlantic are about saying what they're trying to do. Right? Well, I'm trying to protect privacy. Well, what's that? You know, can you define privacy? What do you mean you're trying to protect? What is your goal here? That goal cannot be just to establish control, because individual control, if nothing else, is impossible today. Even under the rule of law, it is not going to be achievable. And therefore, if control is our only objective, or our primary objective, or our best objective, we are going to fail before we ever get started. Fourth, and this is very much focused to the US situation and countries that have tended to follow the US model, we need to adopt substantive rules where appropriate. In many countries, including Europe, but focusing primarily on the United States, we have tended to rely on procedural rules. Right? Provide notice, then you can do what you want. Get consent, then you can do what you want. The effect is that we have created an area of, for example, consumer protection law that is unlike any other part of consumer protection law. We don't allow you to consent to be defrauded. We don't allow you consent to bait and switch advertising. Why would we allow you to consent to uses of data that are acknowledged to be harmful or have a very high risk of serious harm? And even though we are talking about something as sensitive and important as flows of information, something I take very, very seriously, we still must recognize at some point we may have to say there are just some things you cannot do. Or there are some things which are going to require extraordinary, for example, government permission before you can do. Conversely, by the way, there may be some things you ought to be permitted to do without ever going back to a government agency or getting consent. So for example, in the United States, the Federal Trade Commission has proposed that data needed to complete a transaction in which the consumer has voluntarily entered ought to be able to flow without further discussion with the individual. Right? When I use my credit card at the station this morning, I know that station's got to contact my bank to settle that. That is not the time to give me a notice telling me about it. Right? It's got to happen. Some rules should simply clarify what you can or cannot do. Fifth, where we do regulate, we need to focus most on real harms. Right? We need to identify, and this may not be the same in every part of the world, but we need to not shy away from the process of identifying what are the risks here we are talking about. Are they risks to physical safety, to economic safety? Are they risks to human dignity? What are the risks we are worried about? And focus our legislative and regulatory efforts on preventing those risks rather than on, again, as I quoted earlier from Commissioner Hacohen, ensuring the bureaucracy of privacy. Sixth, where we do use notice and choice, and there will be places we should use notice and choice, we should reserve those for settings in which they're likely to be meaningful and effective. right? Ask for my consent where A, I have a real choice to make, and B, where making that choice has some real effect in my life. So for example, marketing might be a good example for consent. There are lots of different ways you can market to me. It's perfectly reasonable to think I might have something to say about which are most intrusive, which are less intrusive, and giving the individual choice there might make a great deal of sense. Right? There are other areas. For example, in the United States, we followed the United Kingdom, I would like to point out, in permitting our border patrol agents to seize and copy portable electronic devices, laptops, cell phones, PDAs. When our Department of Homeland Security had to do a privacy assessment of this as required by law, they concluded it did not affect privacy because we provided timely notice. Well, think about that. The federal government can seize the contents of your laptop and there's no privacy issue because we tell you we have the power to do it. Surely we could do better than this. That's not a place where notice is a reliable privacy protection. And we should use notice and choice where they will be effective, or at least have a chance of being effective. Seventh, in thinking about data protection broadly, it is critical that we shift the burden away from individuals to processors. Europe has gone much further in doing this than the United States has, but nevertheless, in both countries, there remain enormous burdens on individuals, and one effect of our over-reliance on notice and choice is to shift that burden. Eighth, we need to be, I know this sounds hopelessly naive, a little more realistic. Realistic about what we can accomplish, realistic about the competing interests, realistic, frankly, about what consumers and individuals are willing to tolerate. Right, Chris and I both had the pleasure of being at the International Data Protection Commissioners Conference that was held in Strasbourg 2 years ago, where the major focus was on Facebook. Well, think about this for a moment. If you're a data protection or a privacy commissioner, Facebook is kind of a slap in your face. You're spending all your time trying to protect people's privacy, and 700 million of them have signed up to give away all of their data to anybody who wants to look at it. Right. At some point, we need to take account of the world in which we live and conclude what battles are worth fighting. Some may be. We may say, look, the 700 million are wrong and we're going to try to bring them back from the brink. But we need to be explicit and careful about that. Ninth, we must be comprehensive. And I mean comprehensive to cover a lot of ground, especially since I had to eliminate my 11th. Possibility. So for example, we need to deal both with first and third pillar issues. We need to get government data processing, even for national security and intelligence purposes, brought within the system. It frankly doesn't make any sense at all to regulate extensively Google and Microsoft, but then leave national security authorities free to surveil phone calls, use the data as they wish, seize laptops at the borders or what you wish. But we also need to think comprehensively about the broader range of challenges other than just privacy related to data. We talk a lot about data being the currency of the 21st century information age. But that means something. If it really is currency, if it really is what is going to define the way in which we interact with each other, then, for example, we need to be concerned about a broad range of issues. For example, accessibility, right? Are the data there when we need them? When I'm checked into the hospital for stepping off and looking the wrong way, which I do almost every time in the United Kingdom, will my records be there? Protecting my privacy won't help me one little bit if it means I die on the operating table because my record is made inaccessible. Security is another critical issue. Accuracy is going to matter enormously. In the United States today, if you are hired, which is a good thing, you want to be hired, the employer has 3 days to report your information into an automated service provided by the federal government designed to test whether you have the legitimate right to work. You're either a citizen or you have a work permit. Right? That system is reported to have a 7% inaccuracy rate. That's not bad. That means 7 out of 100 people will be denied the right to work while an appeal is lodged. That's a really significant issue. The same thing with boarding airplanes, with security around other things. Accuracy is really going to matter a lot as we depend more and more on data. Finally, I know the word you've been waiting for. we need to build global solutions. And if that is unrealistic, which it almost certainly is, we need to at least avoid nationalistic solutions. The European Data Protection Supervisor, Peter Eustinks, put it this way in 2007, whereas the jurisdiction of the community legislator is limited to the territory of the European Union, the external borders become less relevant for data flows. The economy depends more and more on global networks. In general, the physical place of a processing operation is less relevant. I think that's certainly true. It was true in 2007. It's even more true today. One of the things that former UK Commissioner Thomas is fond of saying in speeches, so I feel perfectly free to borrow from him, is a 2003 study which estimated that there were 63,000 multinational corporations with 821,000 subsidiaries. They employ 90 million people. The largest 1,000 of those multinational corporations accounts for 80% of the world's industrial output. We can safely assume that a multinational corporation trades data every single day. By what standard do we think data protection commissioners, 1,000 of them, 2,000 of them, 5,000 of them, are going to regulate those data transactions? By what standard are we going to administer an adequacy determination? So in order to have any chance of meeting the earlier principles, for example, to be realistic or to be effective, it is critical that we find a way to deal with these distinctions among different national and regional data protection regimes so as to achieve a more harmonized approach. As important as that is today, it's going to be even more critical, of course, with cloud computing. Right? Imagine a world in which your data and the applications that make your data meaningful are stored in clouds which literally have no meaningful jurisdictional basis. If we spend this much time, as we have over the past decade, fighting about where are your data located and which law applies, privacy will be a completely lost concept. We must take this seriously. The risk is not simply that we impede data flows that are critical to the economy, or that we impede data flows that are critical to security, or that we impede data flows that are critical to research. The greater risk, of course, is that we leave our information unprotected. In a world in which data really is the currency of our lives, privacy is, of course, more important than ever before, and so getting this right is more important. It is unthinkable to think we will do this without law. It is just simply not possible to think we will solve this just with technology or just with business processes or just with good behavior. Ultimately, it will take law, and so far, law has not been very instructive or effective in this area. And we simply cannot afford to continue that situation. So let me stop there and happily take your questions, or feel free to give you an opportunity to respond.